There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more. Welcome back to Cutting the Distance. Today's guest has been able to combine his two passions of bow hunting and mechanical engineering into designing and producing some of the best broadheads available today. Bill Vanderhaden has been bow hunting for 40 years. He grew up hunting whitetails in Wisconsin before moving to Colorado 24 years ago. He still hunts whitetails, but his focus is now primarily on western big game, with backcountry elk hunting being his absolute favorite. He's been a mechanical engineer for 30 years with an emphasis on mechanical design and materials science. He's developed products for other companies for many years, including high-tech, aerospace, and medical devices, before starting Ironwell Outfitters and focusing completely on broadheads and aero components just recently. He's also an adjunct instructor of mechanical engineering at University of Colorado, where he's currently sponsoring and directing projects related to the science of bow hunting. So welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
I know you just returned from a bear hunt up in Canada. It looked like a great time with some great results. Go ahead and give us a little snapshot into that hunt.
Yeah, I've been going up to Saskatchewan in the spring for, I think it's my fourth trip up there in the last 5 or 6 years, and just seeing some giant bears. And I got a good one last year, but this year it was just a tank of a bear, 473 pound. And man, my heart was beating hard when I saw him coming through the woods. But yeah, a great bear. Just huge.
Yeah, the pictures were impressive. And a lot of times on bears, it seems like pictures don't do them justice. So I can only imagine how big that guy was. But yeah, for upper fours, you know, if we're getting into that almost 500 range, that is a giant. So congrats on that. No, appreciate having you on. We're going to talk a lot about what I consider, you know, the killing end of the stick for a lot of us archery hunters. And so I'm really excited. But like every episode, we're going to jump in to listener questions or some questions that I was able to scrounge up that people had, knowing that I was going to have you on a guest today. So like every episode, if you have questions for me or my guests, please submit them to us at ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com or send us a message on social and we'll do our best to get them included. So I've got 5 or 6 questions here. Once again, I went to the Is It September Yet? Facebook page, group, you know, a bunch of diehard archery elk hunters. And so I've got a list of questions I'm going to throw at you here, Bill.
Sounds good.
So I don't know if there's a science to it, but we're going to call this first question. Can you explain kind of the science of a good blood trail? This question comes to us from Derek Klein from Is It September Yet?
Yeah, I'd say there's kind of probably 3 factors there. There's, you know, shot placement. Are your blades able to slice all the way through? And then, you know, what's the shape and size of the holes really? And
yep.
So shot placement is going to be number 1. If you get the heart lung area and you got a low exit hole, you know, probably going to be a great blood trail. If you're hitting a high back lung shot, you know, just below the spine, high and back, those can be not so good, you know?
Yep.
You've got, you know, the blood's got to flow down the sides of the animal. Also, you know, you cut the top of the lung, but that kind of shrinks down. Not a lot of bleeding coming from that. You shoot a gut shot, maybe, that, you know, often the guts can kind of plug the hole, and the stuff coming out might not be bright red. It might be kind of more brownish or something. So that can be tough too. So, you know, shot placement is probably number one, but if you just get into the broadheads, then, you know, the bigger and the more open the hole, is going to generally give a better blood trail. So just a two blade slice can sometimes close up and, give you a really poor blood trail, even if the slicing was kind of good through the middle. They can be good, but that's kind of a potential issue with just a straight two blade. A three blade can give you more of a hole then, because, you know, you don't, it's not a single slice that can close up. You've got more of a maybe triangular shape inside. And I would put a two blade with bleeders in that same category. You get a cross cut there. Inside corners can't really stay tension, so they pull back and there's a bit of a hole there. In a single bevel with the rotation, and I prefer a single bevel with bleeders, with that rotation, that can give more of almost a square hole, because that rotation, the way it cuts to the hide. So that hole opens up holes nicely. But the other factor, and I would also say, you know, kind of bigger the better. You know, our wide broadhead series gives a wider cut than our standard, and in general is going to give more, you know, more blood getting out of the animal, more tissue is sliced as you go through. But one other factor that a lot of people don't think about is that sharpness and edge retention is really important as well, I believe. I've done some testing where you just push the different broadheads through, say, like a liver or a lung, you know, of an animal after you get it. And you can see that with iron wool broadheads that are very sharp with good edge retention, you get that complete cut of the sides of the head as it goes through. It's slicing everything. It's not really pushing tissue aside. Whereas a lot of heads, they're with cheaper blades, those edges are dull by the time they get through the hide and for sure a rib. And so they push a lot of tissue aside after that. Don't slice it. So there's a lot less bleeding involved.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you know, I just relate the sharpness to, you know, when you cut yourself with a brand new razor, you know, it seems like it takes forever to stop bleeding. And so I've always felt sharpness, but then, like you said, keeping that thing sharp, you know, we've all ran our knife through hide, we've all ran our knife, you know, along a bone, and it doesn't take very long. So the initial sharpness, but then the ability to hold that through as it gets through the animal or out the other side, in my opinion, is one of those like very important aspects to have that exit hole bleeding. And have you found, or I mean, it's very tough to do, but a lot of times we get more blood out of that exit side. This is something I've always talked about. Your exit hole on a broadhead always seems to be bigger, and I'm going to let you clear up anything I say that may be a mistake here. But when you on your entry side, let's say you have a rib cage that's backing the hide, it almost guarantees that since there's no stretch to that hide, you're going to get a hole that's the exact size of your broadhead, unless you come in at an angle, you know, but you're basically going to get a mirror of your broadhead that goes in. But on the opposite side, that hide will stretch a little bit depending on the sharpness and the angle and whatnot. And as you imagine that hide stretching over the broadhead before it finally starts to slice, you typically will get that bigger exit side. And you know, growing up or everything, you always, you know, the exit hole is always bigger. They bleed more out of it. Have you found that to be true, or are they very similar?
I think that's probably true in general, that the exit holes seem to be a little bigger than entrance. With single bevels, I'd say that it seems to not be the case so much, because that rotation on entrance and the way it's twisting and cutting, I see kind of more similar. It's pretty open hole on both sides. Gotcha. with a single bevel with bleeders.
Yep. And we'll get into it here in a little bit. One of the reasons I like actually a narrower head is to ensure that I get those two holes if I do everything right on my side, which isn't necessarily, it doesn't relate back to the lethality of the broadhead, you know, the animal's probably still going to die. It's my ability to get more evidence on the ground, you know, so I can track the thing to its final location and not necessarily lose it. You know, around here, we've got a bunch of needles or old growth they may run into. And the more blood we can get on the ground, the better. And then one other thing I was going to touch, you'd mentioned like a high lung shot, and the result of bloods. We've hit a lot of animals high lung. And I will say, once again, they die maybe faster than other ones because it does fill up their lungs with blood very quickly and stuff. You know, does the killing through that mechanism. But yeah, very, very little blood. Now, it is a great shot if, you know, to very quick and ethical, but doesn't yield very good blood. So it's that balance of, hitting them there versus getting a blood trail. So I'll diverge on that topic. We're going to get into penetration and some of the other things I personally look for on big, Western big game. But no, thanks for answering Derek Klein's question there on blood trail sharpness, 2, 3, or 4 blades. I think we covered it all there. There was one thing I'm going to add to this. Do you find any difference in blood trails, single to double bevel? Does that affect, aside from what you've already mentioned, that entry hole, or would you say that, you know, regardless of the angle of the blade and all of that, they yield pretty similar blood trails, everything else being equal?
I would say with a two blade head, if you have a two blade without bleeder and you compare a double bevel to a single bevel, I would give single bevel a little advantage there because there's kind of an S cut as it rotates in. So it's not really a straight slit like you get with a straight two blade without bleeders. And then with once you add the bleeders on a single bevel and get that rotation there, it does. I mean, if you look at the holes through the hide on both sides, they are more open with that rotation. I would say that I've seen good blood trails with both, really, our double bevel with the bleeder and then our single bevel with the bleeder. There's a lot of cutting going on and the holes are opening up both sides. I think they both do really well. I might give a little advantage though to the single bevel with bleeder just because of the way it opens up those holes, especially the entrance hole.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So thanks for that. We're going to jump into the next question here. Can you explain the warranty of iron will broadheads and kind of what that covers and what led you to that warranty?
Yeah. So, you know, the reason for that initially was that, I spent many years trying to design, develop a broadhead that would cut through bone and stay sharp, not get damaged, you know, get you through that shoulder bone on an elk. Really, that's a failure that I had. And what really got me started in this. And after many years of different steels and heat treat processes, developed a steel and then a ferrule material as well that was high strength to where I could pound through the heaviest of bones and have no damage to the broadhead. So, you know, because of that and the cost of our heads, we had a lifetime, you know, guarantee. You bend or break it, we replace it. We had enough abuse initially with people shooting them into, you know, concrete blocks or into heavy wood over and over and, you know, bending them, getting them out, that we kind of changed the warranty a bit to say any shot, you know, at or through an animal, it's warranted. We'll replace it. If it gets damaged shooting at or through an animal, even if it hits rock on the other side of the animal, but, you know, in a hunting situation. But we don't want people shooting them. I mean, some people would shoot groups into targets all summer long until all the blades were damaged and then, you know, want to replace with 3-pack. So yep. We just kind of limited it. It doesn't cover target shooting or, you know, intentionally shooting it, you know, rocks or concrete or steel, but anything in a hunting situation we do cover. Yeah. Warranty.
So it's basically not to reword, but it's some common sense applied to hunting scenarios and making sure you're not smashing broadheads together and shooting stuff that they weren't intended to shoot through. It sounds like a great warranty there, and at least protect the product for what it was intended to do.
Right. We want you to be able to. So they're not single use heads, and that's a new concept for a lot of people. You know, we've had people shoot, and I probably have as well, shoot the same broadhead through several animals, maybe 10 animals, and keep using that broadhead. You typically, you know, might need to touch up the edges to for sharpness after a couple, but you can keep using them. And that's the intention there, is that when people know that once you buy them, you can use these for many years. Just take some care with the, you know, target shooting and things to to not shoot them into something like a steel plate or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you talk about after, being able to reuse those, same thing here. And one thing I really loved about them, when I used to use replaceable bladed, more mass produced replaceable bladed broadheads, that was one thing, like shooting into the target, I could feel, throughout a summer, like these things are getting dull when you switched over, where it's, the iron will, I can just keep shooting and the thing never, it's, whatever you do to the edge, whatever you've got done with the sharpness there, it's like a foam target really doesn't mess with that. And so I love like being able to get an arrow dialed in with a specific broadhead, knowing that however it's set up is a great combo and it's flying well. I don't have to mess with it. I don't have to worry about sharpening it, because I've shot it 100 times into foam.
We generally say if you're going to shoot 5 times, I think I've measured up to 10, but we kind of say if you want to shoot every broadhead arrow, in your quiver and make sure that it's flying well, just shoot once or twice with each arrow at, 50 yards or whatever makes you comfortable that arrow is going to fly well. But 5 times or less in like a foam target like Reinhardt Matrix, I can't measure any difference to that edge sharpness. And that's because our hardness is 60 Rockwell C. So that's a very hard, strong edge. And then we do a multi-stage grinding and honing, get it very sharp. And it retains that edge really well. And that's why you can generally shoot through an animal and one pass through of, hide ribs, exiting into, just say dirt. You can typically clean it up, see if it's still kind of shaven hair and put it back in your quiver, keep using it. And if it does get dull to the point where it's not shaving hair, you pretty quickly, touch it up and keep using it too.
Yep. Yep. All right. So the next question comes from Chase. Hopefully I don't mess up the last name. Eagley. Do your vented heads whistle or make noise?
Yeah. In general, vented heads have a little bit of like a shush to them, I guess.
Yep.
In flight, our solid heads, I did sound testing years ago and we just actually repeated it this past year with a study we're doing at the University of Colorado on aero vane designs for improved flight with fixed blade broadheads. And sound recording was part of that. We looked at the sound from the shot to, passing through, which would basically be when the animals hit. And then looked at the frequency content as well. And what I would say is that our saw blade heads are very quiet. We saw similar to field point type sound amplitude on those. So they're excellent. And our vented blades are a bit louder. Our original V series with the small vents are probably our loudest head. And then our wide series with the larger vents, that vent is a bit quieter. It's kind of like blowing through a whistle versus a tube a bit there. But we saw in both cases, though, and this is why I don't think it's as big of a deal as some people do, is that, you get the sound of the bow going off, and then the arrows, and really that bow noise is still, there's still vibration noise coming from that bow when the arrow is 5 to 10 yards downrange already. And then it gets really quiet until the arrow gets pretty close to that animal. Or the target, and then it flares up. So, and if we looked at the segment that was say 15 to 10 yards from the animal, it was very hard to pick up a difference between different vanes, different broadheads, anything there. So I think it's a bit, I don't think it's as big of a concern as some people have. I think that sound from vanes or broadhead blades or vents doesn't really flare up until it's so close to the animal that it's probably not as big a factor as people think.
Yeah. And you may know better than me. I'd have to go research it or Google it. I can't remember the speed of sound versus the speed of a typical arrow. Do you know which one's traveling faster at that point?
Speed of sound, I think, is like 1200 feet per second in your arrows,
Yeah. 300. So, I mean, that animal is your arrow is never going to outrun the bow. I didn't know the numbers, but I knew this idea that there's no, regardless of that arrow whistling, that animal is going to hear your bow before an arrow ever matters. Yeah. And so it's like, in my mind, just comparing the speeds, it's like, all right, that the sound of my bow going off and with any reasonable archery distance, that animal's been made aware of my bow before he's ever going to recognize the arrow making a whistle.
Yeah. I mean, my current thinking on this, and I try not to make gut decisions. I try to make analyze, do data-driven decisions on things. But I kind of feel like, you know, because a lot of people say, you know, from a video, you can see that the animal didn't move at the shot of the bow. He moved from the, you know, sound of the arrow later. But really that arrow is, you know, a quarter of the way there, maybe when he hears it, when he hears the bow go off. And that bow noise continues, you know, for another 5 or 10 yards of that arrow travel.
Yep.
And now he's looking that way. And, you know, deer and animals in general have excellent vision for movement. So he looks over that way. Maybe he sees movement of the hunter or whatever, or maybe even sees the arrow in flight. You know, and then I think with that movement, with that sound, they're deciding, am I going to bolt or not? And they start moving, and, you know, and there's a little bit of time just to register from the sound yep. to when an animal can react. So my feeling is, yeah, maybe he moved when the arrow was, maybe started moving when the arrow was halfway there, but it's still that initial sound of the bow, him looking over, maybe something he saw with his vision that's making him react that way.
Yeah.
That's kind of my feeling. Not so much the sound of the vein or the
broadhead,
but you know, that's not the general thinking in industry. I'm just trying to apply science and what I've kind of learned so far.
Yeah, for sure. That's all we can do, right? And that's where I love being able to balance the science versus what we see out there is real world results and kind of blending those two. So next question comes from Chris Pasto. What's your best practice for sharpening iron wool broadheads or any broadheads for that matter?
Yeah. I would say first off, when you get our broadheads, don't sharpen them. They're very sharp already. It'll be difficult to achieve, you know, the edge sharpness we have. We can zoom into 200X and it's still, you know, dead sharp to 1/10,000th of an inch. And so our sharpness starts way sharper than many. But in general, I would say that when you get broadheads, it's good to check sharpness. You'd be surprised at how many aren't sharp out of the box, especially like a one piece solid construction, you know, two or three blade. Often, a lot of times those just have a milled edge, milled bevels to them. So just a note, first off, when you get heads, check to see if they're sharp, make sure they're sharp or sharpen them when you get them. RG shouldn't need to do that. And then it kind of depends on how much that edge is worn away. Generally with ours, it's kind of like a high-end knife. The hardness, the sharpness is very good to start with. And you can typically go through, you know, hide, meat, even a rib, and have that edge be pretty good. So I would first just clean it up, check and see if it's still sharp, shaven hair, or you can see if it kind of cuts paper. If it's good, just leave it. If the edges still look good, you don't see any flats or rolled edge or anything like that, but it's not quite shaving hair, cutting paper. Then I just, and there's videos on our YouTube channel that show this, but I just start with like an extra fine stone and by hand kind of hold the bevel to kind of match the bevel, just tip it slightly so that I'm contacting the edge and just, you know, a few strokes back and forth over and over and then lightning pressure. And really it's about a minute and a half of doing that on an edge. And I'm typically able to shave hair again. If it's been dulled, I guess more than that, then that's when I guess the foolproof kind of way to do it, I think, is to remove the blade, clamp it into a knife sharpener or a broadhead jig, but you know, put a marker on the beveled edge. And then I like the knife sharpeners where you can set the angle and have flat stones. So you can adjust the angle until just one light kind of scrape against that stone is removing that marker that you put on all the way to the edge. So, you know, you're kind of matching the bevel, cleaning up to the edge.
Yep.
And then you can, you maybe just start with a fine and then extra fine, or if it's a bit more beat up, you might go medium fine, extra fine, but you're taking strokes on one side and then the other, back and forth and kind of regrinding that edge all the way to the tip. As you can go to finer stones, you can get, you know, a finer, sharper edge. You know, we can get into more details on this, but as you're doing it initially, you want to clean up that edge to where you can feel a burr all along that edge coming out to the other side. Then you know you clean up that full edge. and you're doing it back then on the other side to bring it back. And then as you go to the finer stones, you're kind of working a smaller burr. And then at the end, it's, you know, you've just taken it completely off and it's dead sharp.
Yeah. I like to use, I've had a few broadheads get to that point. A lot of times I can just pick it up, you know, flip my thumb across it. It's still really sharp, good enough to shoot another animal with. But yeah, when I get to that point, I don't remember the kind, but it's a work sharp that basically, you know, rotate your blade 180. You can set the exact angle you want. So I just kind of look at the side, make sure that, you know, yeah, I'm contacting the tip, but I'm also kind of maintaining that angle. So I'm getting a real smooth, and then just, you know, run it down the blade. It holds it at the perfect, you know, 22, 22 and a half, whatever it may be for a double bevel or, you know, whatever that angle may be. And then, yeah, you can touch them up really good. I do notice that, like, you know, the since you do get it to a hardness of 60, it sometimes can be a little bit more difficult than I would say like a cheaper steel to get that. You have to work out a little bit more, but I found that work sharp lets me get those things dialed right back in without removing too much material and kind of maintaining that angle really well.
Yeah, it's A2 tool steel. So it's a steel used in metal stamping dies to cut other metals. And it kind of has a unique ability to have great impact toughness and retain an edge and sharpness, even when cutting through something like metal. I'd say it's a pretty workable steel since it's a tool steel. It doesn't have, it's not like some super steels that have such hard carbide particles in it that that it's really difficult or you need special, you know, stones or equipment to sharpen. Yeah. I'd say it's definitely doable with standard sharpening stones, but yeah. It would take a little bit more work than say a soft, you know, 420.
Yeah. Like yes. It's, I know it's not near as difficult as like the S30Vs, S90Vs and stuff we used to try to sharpen. I'm like, man, I can't remember how to run a knife sharpener anymore. Cause you'd sit and struggle with those. And then, you know, eventually figured out how to get those sharp again. But yeah, it's definitely easier than that, but maybe a little more work than softer steels. So
yes.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time, Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who has used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way that they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more. The next question comes from AJ Doobie. How much helical for a single bevel would you recommend?
Yeah, kind of like 2 to 3 degrees. And this is part of the university study too. We were looking at with a high-speed camera as the arrow comes out of the bow and how quickly does it spin up? And then, you know, what's the maximum spin it gets down range? And so, I mean, I don't like 0 to 1 degree. I mean, zero, definitely you're not getting any rotation. And the reason you want rotation in an arrow is it kind of averages out any asymmetries. You know, if your insert or broadhead is pointing a little bit off to one side, and then as you shoot the arrow without rotation, it's just going to drive the arrow off to that direction. Whereas if you have rotation, it might open up your groups a little bit, but it's going to keep it much closer to, you know, on the bullseye. So you want rotation. And I think 2 to 3 degrees is a pretty good amount, I think, on a vane to relatively quickly spin that arrow up so you get the accuracy advantages. But I don't really see a need to get a very high rotation. I think at impact, you know, super high rotation, it seems like it'd probably be a negative thing. But what I've tested from, you know, I've tested like 2.5 to 3 degree helical with our current single bevels, and that seems to do a really good job. We've got high speed video on our YouTube channel actually of passing through a deer, and you can see that the arrow is rotating at impact and it just keeps rotating right through that animal. Doesn't miss a beat there with a single bevel head. So yeah, I like the 2 to 3 degree range for shooting really any fixed blade broadhead, but definitely seems to work well with single bevels too.
Gotcha. And I'm going to piggyback on AJ's question. Some of the stuff I don't claim to be an expert on. I've shot helical, you know, right-handed twist, you know, double bevel broadhead. So I haven't had to deal with a lot of this, but you know, single bevels are sold left or right twist, right? And then you've got the ability to helical left or right, but then you've also got the idea that a bow naturally wants to spin an arrow a certain direction. So we take those three things that could all work together, could work apart from each other, or you know, you could have two working in one direction, one in the other. What's your opinion on that? Should we go to, because it's something I've never thought of. It's nothing I've ever went through. You know, when I was growing up bow hunting, it was always about you don't want to spin the arrow so that it wants to loosen your broadhead, you know, or the ferrule from the insert. And so you always, you know, everything spun to the, you know, you wanted your arrow spin to the right, kind of kept your broadhead locked in. What's your take, your opinion? Is there any research that supports those things should all match? How do we figure it out? I know it's a lot all in one question, but if you can kind of elaborate on that whole idea.
Yeah, I think the important thing, or the most important thing, if you're going to shoot single bevel, is that your vanes and your bevel match. You know, you want that arrow rotation as it hits the animal to continue in that direction. So, and I think you can do 2 to 3 degree. Offset or helical. And if you're doing right offset or helical, then do a right single bevel. If you're doing left offset or helical, just do a left single bevel, because you want that rotational momentum that's providing some of the torque to go through the animal, which is kind of needed with single bevel. You know, a single bevel, all that pressure on that bevel causes the rotation as you go through the animal, but you don't want it to like stop that rotation and have to change direction and go back the other way. You lose energy and penetration there. So that's the most important part of this whole thing. The other question is really the kind of the clocking, they call it, of the bow. Or if you shoot a bear shaft out of your bow, which way is that arrow going to rotate? And this isn't really done by design. I mean, ideally the arrow would just come straight out of a bow. You know, the bow manufacturers aren't doing something in particular to make it rotate left to right. There's just kind of an imbalanced force on it that might go left or right. And, you know, generally that's due to the string twist and the serving and how that knock just kind of releases from it. I first heard about this maybe 12 years ago or so. And when I first tested it on my bow at that time, I was getting like 1/4 inch rotation left over 12 feet. Well, I knew from high-speed video that my arrow was getting like a full rotation right in like 10 inches or something from the vanes when they're at 2.5 to 3 degrees. So, and you know, from engineering, some of the torques equals I alpha. It's, you know, that rotational, angular acceleration, I guess. So to me, like that little bit of torque left and all this torque right from the vane, don't worry about it. That was kind of my initial thoughts on it. And I've still kind of tell people in general, it's not that big of a factor. I mean, if you want to really dig into the details and the weeds, I mean, I do see with high-speed video that if the bow tends to want to make it rotate a little bit left, there's a little bit more of a hesitation there before the right rotation starts. So I'm not going to say that it doesn't matter at all, but I'm not so sure that it, I don't think it probably matters a whole lot in accuracy, at least not for the average guy. And I'm not even sure for the pros. You know, I've talked to pros that started doing it, but they said they aren't really seeing a difference in accuracy. So yeah. I'm a bit on the fence on that whole thing, but it's one of those details that there's a lot of other things to worry about,
yeah,
bigger factors than that.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Thanks for diving into that one for me. So the next question comes from Ryan Randall. Are there any plans for a traditional 3 or 4 blade head in Iron Will's future?
Yeah. Good question. You know, our 2 blade with bleeders is basically a 4 blade,
yep,
with an advantage, I think. Putting that bleeder back away from the tip is an improvement for splitting bone, for instance. If you're, and it's really why I like a 2 blade with bleeders over a 3 blade as well. If you think about hitting a scapula with a 2 blade head, it just has to make one split through it. And that takes quite a bit less force than like a 3 blade where you're splitting in 3 different directions at once. It's a lot more force. And we've got some force testing data on our website that shows this, but just pushing down through hide muscle and scapula with our 2 blade with bleeders versus a 3 blade, I think the force was like 5 times as much with that 3 blade, trying to make that split out 3 ways. And I hear about this all the time, people shooting a 3 blade head into scapula on an elk and not penetrating through where ours penetrates very easily through. So will I ever make a 3 blade? You know, I'm considered it. You know, there's a lot of people that are just stuck on shooting 3 blade heads,
yep,
and want me to make a better one. And so I might, but I actually think a 2 blade with bleeders is a better option for still getting a nice entrance exit hole, cutting a similar amount of tissue if you look at the total cut, but yeah, it penetrates bone and hide and everything else much better.
Yep. No, I'm in agreement there. You know, the only advantage I ever saw to a 3 blade was the idea that hole may not, it may stay more open, but I think we still accomplish that. Like you said, the tension from the center of that hole on a 4 blade does the same thing and kind of keeps that hole open. But then, you know, people have talked about, well, you know, just basically 2 blades crossing, they can still close, but I agree. You kind of get that middle open. So, yeah, thanks for taking that one on. And now the last question, the question we had got from a few guys is, why are they so expensive? And I'd like to rearrange this question and ask you, why are Iron Wills worth what you charge for them? And, you know, if you can go through the manufacturing process, QAQC materials, finishing, hardening, all of that, and kind of give us a look into why these broadheads, you know, cost what they cost.
Yeah, good question. You know, when I first had a broadhead fail on an elk shoulder blade in 2004, and it was pretty devastating for me at the time. And, you know, I was a mechanical engineer, had developed products for other companies for many years at a high level. And then I took a look at this broadhead, you know, really critically, and decided quickly that this thing's junk. It's prone to failure. And I really just decided, well, I first, you know, researched and tested a lot of other heads out there, but then at the end decided to really just start from scratch. And not think about low-cost manufacturing, but think about how can I get the highest possible performance out of this broadhead to for sure get through an elk shoulder bone, get through the vitals, make that a successful hunt instead of, you know, a heartbreak. And you know, I'd also had a background when I first graduated from engineering school. I went to work for a 3M company. At the time, with development engineers, they'd have you spend like 20% of your time on a technology development project. And coming out of school, I kind of had an emphasis in kind of mechanical design, machine design, but then also advanced materials engineering and steels in particular. So the technology development program they gave me was tooling technology development for the corporation. So I was digging heavily into steels, tool steels, heat treats, coatings, you know, other things to try and improve tools that we're doing, you know, cutting materials, cutting metals, you know, really kind of all the different tooling things that are used in a big manufacturing corporation. So, you know, I dug deep into the steels, worked with different steel suppliers and things like that. So I had that background as well. So, you know, I just knew there was that, you know, most of the blades out there were using like a 420 stainless steel, which is not really even a good blade steel. It's kind of a nice compromise of being very cheap and doing okay. But anyway, I went through five different steels before I settled on A2 tool steel. I used S7 as well, which is a great impact steel. And really, they're both used in metal stamping dies and punches. S7 is generally used to punch or form metal. A2 is often used if you're going to cut metal. And so even though I liked S7 and used it for a couple years in development, I decided A2 was kind of a better because I could get it harder, sharper, retain the edge better. Anyway, and you know, I process it like you would a high-end knife blade. We start with you know, steel plate, blank that out. We do CNC machining, multi-stage grinding, honing. We do a heat treat process that includes a cryogenic treatment and triple tempering to just get the best possible. We can geek out on why we do that, but you do this cryogenic treatment, you make sure all the, you know, it's basically making sure the microstructure is perfectly, you know, changed. It goes from austenite to martensite, and it's a very hard, dense structure, and to make sure it's all uniform. And then the tempering adds the toughness. Anyway, we spent a year just working on the heat treat once we chose the steel. And so all these steps in that process, you know, add cost versus typical blades are, they're done on a reel to reel. There's a reel of metal coming in one side, and you can do that when blades are, you know, 20, 30, maybe even 35, 40 thou thick. You can just have a roll of steel coming into a stamping machine to where it's feeding through on a strip. It's stamped, and a lot of these machines, they grind it right, they sharpen right there too. They stamp, run through a one side grinder. You know, it comes off the other side of the machine, and these parts cost, these blades cost dimes to make versus dollars to make. So anyway, that's kind of why ours is more expensive. And that's, you know, kind of explain the blades or ferrules. We use a grade 5 titanium for our lighter heads, and that's really the best strength to weight ratio of any metal. So I think that's the best metal to use on a ferrule on, say, 100 grain head. We use it on some of our 100, 125 grain heads when you really want the best strength to weight ratio. And then as we go to our heavier weights, we use a hardened steel, which is, you know, you can, all steels aren't created equal. Most steel, you know, all steel, say ferrules or heads out there are generally 302 stainless, which is not hardened. You can harden, you can use martensitic steel, harden it and get strength that's, you know, maybe two to three times the strength of those austenitic, you know, 300 series steels. So, and we actually harden them and machine them in the hardened state. So it requires that we machine them slower. It takes longer to machine. The material costs more. So that's why those cost more as well. But we can get very precise. There's no, you know, distortion or discoloration from a later heat treat. And it's really kind of the best way to make the parts that you can. And I'm all about performance. I'm a development engineer, and I want to use the best process to make the best product. And, you know, kind of let the costs fall where they do. And that's really why our broadheads cost quite a bit.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm the same way, you know, sometimes with our calls, you know, it's like, let's just design the best call we can and roll up the cost of goods and figure out where that thing needs to be profitable, you know, and that's, we've let that lead a lot of our projects. But yeah, for me, you know, and not to over dramatize it, but you know, we spend, not trying to justify, you basically gave us the reason on the price. But for me as a user of your product, you know, you spend all year for the most part planning, thinking, you know, setting up for these hunts, you know, your one or two archery elk hunts, because you can only, you know, maybe three max to squeeze these in. You know, you drive potentially all over the country, you drive across your state, or you drive, you know, you're driving into your unit and you've bought new this or that. Like when it comes down to it, like, do I want to risk the chance that, you know, when I'm at full draw, knowing, you know, the last thing I want to think about is if, you know, is this broadhead going to perform, or if I make a slightly less than perfect shot, like, is it, you know, am I still covered? Like, is the broadhead going to be, you know, and for me, it's easy just to like, I peace of mind knowing that I've got the best broadhead that I've been able to find, you know, on the tip of my arrow.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, all the effort, all the work, you know, to be a bow hunter, there's a lot of preparation and work that goes into it. And when that shot happens on that animal that walks out, and maybe it's the biggest animal you've seen or whatever, but when that animal walks out, what piece of gears matter the most? Well, at that point, it's having good arrow flight and then having your broadhead perform, you know, on impact. So yep. It's, you know, our heads are probably $20 more per head than the things you're going to pick up at a department store. But it's, yeah, to me, it's worth it at that moment of truth there to get that animal and have the best chance for success.
Yeah. Well, that kind of wraps up the listener questions here. I appreciate everybody over Is It September Yet sending us questions. And so once again, you have questions of your own, email them to us at ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com or send us a social message and we'll do our best to include them for me or my guests. So now we're going to jump into kind of my discussion I wanted to have with you, Bill. You know, on Cutting the Distance, we're all about tips and tactics. And I think it's important to kind of, you know, and to become successful, but I believe it's easy to kind of roll broadheads into, you know, finding success and, you know, being able to, you know, technical data surrounds them, you know, the lethality of the broadheads. And so, glad to have you on here. I got a few of my own and I love when things are based on science and data. You know, we're coming off of a few interviews with biologists. Like, I just love being able to look at the data and you know, figure out, does this correlate with what I've seen? Are there anomalies? Are there reasons why what I've seen are different than the data? And just like let the chips fall where they do and, you know, go with that. But you are, you know, similar to me. We've got the engineering side, but then we go out and test all of our products. And I want to see those real world results that support or back up what's found in, you know, in what I believe, what I've been able to find. And I think you and what you're doing with Iron Will broadheads kind of, you know, encapsulates that whole idea. You know, design the best broadheads on paper, do a bunch of testing, and then go out and confirm them on animals. So gonna jump into our conversation with you here. So can we dive a little deeper into your work that you're doing with the University of Colorado? You know, I think there's a lot of just generalities or ideas that have, you know, come from many, many years of bow shop owners or in industry stuff. But you're actually going back and kind of proving that, or, you know, coming up with data that supports that. So give us a little bit of what you're, you know, doing at University of Colorado. You know, you've got new vanes that you're looking at, new arrow setups. Kind of give us the full rundown of you know, lab testing and new products.
Yeah, so to give you a little background there, you know, I developed products for other companies for many years, and I was always seeking out the best, you know, engineering tools, really, whether it was computer modeling, instrumentation, you know, high-speed camera, accelerometers, just whatever kind of instrumentation, you know, analysis tools, really kind of the best engineering tools and applying them to improve products. You know, engineering is really applying science to, you know, solve problems or develop better products. But at the companies I worked for, I always, you know, really drove highest level engineering improvements. And through years of doing that, I was leading engineering teams and, you know, really kind of mentoring and driving other people to, you know, do the, you know, apply science, do the analysis, but then also do some lab testing to kind of prove that, you know, a computer model is accurate. And this, what, you know, the analysis shows will be an improvement actually does make an improvement. And then in the final, you know, final assembly testing, you know, prove out that you did make it better. And so, you know, I was involved, you know, in different companies doing that. And then companies I worked for started sponsoring university projects. And then I was placed as kind of the company, you know, industry client over those projects. And then about 8 years ago, the university asked me to be one of the faculty directors. So I became an adjunct instructor of mechanical engineering and was one of the faculty directors for the senior design project for mechanical engineering. And that's a year-long project where seniors in mechanical engineering are required to do it, but they take an industry project and spend a year doing, you know, analysis, design analysis, prototyping, testing, you know, iterating, bring it to manufacturing typically. So I've been, you know, teaching students kind of best practices for mechanical engineering and trying to kind of bridge that gap between, okay, you have all the school knowledge and, you know, all the tests you've taken, all the information is there. Now, how do you, you know, solve the problem when you have all the information? That's generally what happens in university tests, to where you get in the real world and develop a project and all the information isn't given to you. You have to figure out, what is the science here? What is the physics? How can I apply it? How can I analyze it, test it? So, you know, I've been teaching students to do that. And then this past year, I finally got approval from the university to both direct and sponsor a project. So Iron Wall Fitters is sponsoring a project on improved arrow vane design for bow hunting, you know, with fixed blade broadheads on the front. So it's been a great project. You know, it was five seniors in mechanical engineering that had no background in, you know, archery or bow hunting, which I kind of like. They come into it with no, you know, preconceived ideas of what works or doesn't work. They're just using designing, analyzing, collecting data, and really kind of making data-driven, you know, decisions or showing the results based on that. So this past year, we tested six of what I considered kind of the top hunting vanes in the industry. Did a, you know, CAD model of those at a 3-degree helical on the arrow with Iron Wall broadheads on the front. Did a fluid dynamic model. So it's really a very sophisticated one. It has, you know, airflow going over the arrow, even as it's rotating through the air. We were able to model that. We're looking at really accuracy, stability, wind drift, drag, and sound from that. So we can model all that here. We can, oh, and I don't know if I said spin up as well. So we can kind of model that, how these different vanes will do a better job of that than the other. You know, we can tip the angle at say 5 degrees to the wind, like as if it's coming out of your bow and your bow's a little untuned, and we can see what is the restoring torque that quickly brings that arrow back on track to get it, you know, straight at the target. And so we studied six of the vanes in the industry and then studied some different prototype vanes. But we took it from the, you know, analytical computer modeling to then also to do the empirical testing, the actual testing with a shooting machine using a high-speed camera to kind of verify the spin up and then the stabilizing and then the max rotation. We used lab radar to look at the velocity from the bow to the target to verify the drag and the drop that we calculated through the model. We had a very sophisticated sound recording system placed out there that was recording the sound with these omnidirectional microphones. And then we analyzed that through MATLAB so we could look at the frequency content. And we looked at, you know, the frequency kind of peak range for humans, which I think was 2 to 4 kilohertz, and then also animals, which I believe was 4 to 8 kilohertz. So we said, okay, is this arrow sound, you know, arrow broadhead vane combination sound loud to a person? And also, does it sound loud to an animal? Is it more likely to make an animal react or not? So we took all that data. We just kind of finished up the project. We're going to plan to put out some kind of white papers to summarize that. But that's kind of just the overview of the project. And really, the reason I wanted to sponsor that is I feel like with the broadhead development, I have a broadhead now that is, you know, penetrating really well through hide bone. It's getting in that pass through. And some people a lot of people, I wouldn't say a lot, but some people, their problem with shooting fixed blade heads is that they struggle to get good arrow flight with fixed blade heads. So I wanted to dig more into the science there and kind of be able to show people, hey, you can definitely get great long range flight with fixed blade heads. You just need to do a few things here, you know, get some rotation in your arrow, tuned bow, the right vanes on the back, and you're good.
Gotcha. Yeah, I like it. And I'm excited to see what comes out on that white paper and if it changes anything that we think is right as of right now.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time. Seafoam motor treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who has used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way that they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more. My next question for you is, what's your opinion on FOC? Did the pendulum swing too far? Does it matter? We've went to this, you know, all your weight in the first 2 inches. Like, just give me your take on that and what you've found or what your opinion is on if there's a compromise where we don't have to chase these huge FOC numbers.
Yeah, I don't think there's any science that would show that extreme FOC would be a significant increase in penetration. The science and the physics and the math there is that mass is that momentum is going to equal force times time. Change of momentum will equal force times time. Momentum is a vector quantity, so as a direction. And momentum is mass times velocity. So really the way to maximize your penetration is to maximize that mass times velocity in a straight line. So having good arrow flight so that your arrow is going straight as it impacts the animal, and then, you know, have that increased mass and or velocity can give you that total increased momentum at impact. It's going to translate into how much force can that really aero system apply as it cuts through and for how long. So it's that product of force times time. So there's no FOC in that, in the math or the physics there. There's no center of mass in that calculation. I think it only comes into effect if it's somehow changing how well your arrow is flying or what it's doing at impact. So I think the advantages with FOC, they improve stability. As you move your center of mass a bit forward, you're going to improve your stability. But I personally don't go to any extremes. I think, say, 12 to 15, 16% is great. I've seen excellent penetration. My arrow setups are usually in that 12 to 15% range. And I can tell you through all my testing, with the right broadhead on the front, you have excellent penetration. So I don't see a need for this extreme FOC. The physics doesn't really justify that. I think that Dr. Ed Ashby's testing, I've talked to him about this. He saw now going from a 19 to, I think it was 22% FOC, saw 30% improvement in penetration. I really think that's because he's shooting a longbow at close range and there's a lot of flexing in that arrow, and it probably improved his arrow flight or how straight that arrow was on impact. And that was probably majority of the factor for penetration. And I think it's unfortunate. I think a lot of people have tried to apply that to modern compound bows. And the negative that they do is to try and get extreme FOC. They're often underspined.
Yeah.
Putting that a lot of mass out in front. You don't have the arrow stiffness to support it. You get massive flexing back and forth. And I see this on YouTube videos of people that are extreme FOC, advocates. You can see in their arrow flight, it's that thing's flexing back and forth like crazy. And in my arrow setups, I may be getting like a half inch of vertical flex of the arrow, and then it's almost going perfectly straight, 10 feet later.
Yeah.
I don't want to have that massive flexing back and forth all the way to the target. That's going to reduce penetration because your momentum it's not in a straight line anymore.
Yeah. At that point. No, I'm in that same camp, and then you're like, all right, well, mass is included, so do I just go to a heavy arrow? But then you're once again, if you're chasing heavy arrow and FOC, you end up with an underspined arrow, or you end up with, you end up with a heavy weight, but now you've just given up velocity, which all calculates back into, it's really just a trade-off, and that's where you look at it, and then you also factor in what you saw from, maybe some of the female bow hunters you've hunted with that got perfect pass-throughs at 52, pounds and a 420 grain arrow or whatever it is. And you're like, well, what am I doing as a guy shooting a 72 pound bow and full length arrows, 560 grain. It's like, does it all matter? Or do we just need to be able to shoot our bows better? And hit the animal right where we want. And, I build my arrows somewhat backwards, and I fall into that same 12 to 15% FOC like you do, just kind of naturally. I've got a fairly long draw. I shoot full length 32 inch arrows. And then I just kind of keep stuff in weight in the front until I get my bow to what it says on paper is going to shoot about 280 to 285 feet per second, and just confirm that I'm spined right, and then I move on. I'm not chasing a weight. I'm chasing more of a speed. What does that weight and that tip weight got to do? And then make sure my spine's still in, is correct, and I'm not going to be, under overspined, and just kind of leave it there. Like I build backwards to a speed that I like to shoot, and don't chase FOC or a crazy weighted arrow. Just by my size, I end up with a 550 to 560 grain arrow, but it's just because of the 32 inch draw length and heavy arrows.
Yeah, there's definitely a trade off there. As you increase the mass, your trajectory drops off. And so people ask me, what weight should I go with to maximize penetration? Well, I think you do continue to see improvements with penetration with mass, especially, and the technical reason for this, I think, is because is an animal tissue and everything probably asks a bit like viscoelastic material, where it's like as you increase that shear rate, it takes more force. So a light, fast arrow is going to take more force to go through at that higher speed, and it's going to slow down easier because it's light versus a heavier arrow. And so, but it's not that huge of a factor. So I think I kind of calculated in my setup, I thought 100 grains say going from 450 to 550 might be maybe a 10% improvement in penetration, maybe not quite that much really. But yeah. But then there's a drop off in trajectory as well. And that's why I'm typically end up around 500 grains. But it's why I'm not going 600 plus, because I just get way too much drop off in the trajectory. And having good arrow flight and hitting where you're aiming are really number one.
Yeah, for sure.
And as far as where to put the weight, yeah, up front's better than putting it. You don't really want to put it at the back. And up front's better than having just a heavy arrow with a light head up front. You know, I wouldn't go with a heavy arrow and then only have 100 grains or 116 up front, like some people will do with just a aluminum insert and a 100 grain head. And then your FOC is down at 10% or below. I think say, you know, the recommendations out there in the industry are maybe 10 to 12% for target setups and like 12 to 14 for hunting arrow setups. I think that's what like Easton has said before. I don't like going all the way down to 10 or below. You add the possibility for instability to fix light head. So that's really the reason for having some mass up front and having a decent FOC, but there's no need to go extreme, in my opinion. It's more likely to hurt arrow flight and trajectory.
Yeah. This kind of segue or kind of plays off of what we were just talking about. Do you have much research on, you know, the cutting diameter in relation to penetration? And one thing I've always did, which surprises some people, is I just shoot 100 grain solid head. I want the smallest cutting diameter as possible. Now I want that broadhead to be sharp and do all the other things, but I've always in my head just added weight to my insert or whatnot because I wanted the ultimate penetration. As I mentioned earlier, I've always been in that camp that I want a hole on both sides. I also, if I do encounter bone, I've always thought that a 1-inch cutting diameter is easier to push through that bone than an inch and, you know, an eighth or an inch and a quarter. Do you have any data on cutting diameter in relation to penetration? And if my thought process is right or if it's incorrect?
Well, I totally agree with you that getting that exit holes is important and, you know, cutting all the way through in the exit hole. And I like to shoot our standard width heads on elk. They have like 1 1/16 main blade, 3/4 inch bleeder. It's 1.8 inch total cut, but it's relatively compact and flies well at long range. And that's generally my elk head. And, you know, I'm zipping right through that. It takes such low force to cut through with their heads that often they're going 20 yards and looking around, or sometimes not even moving. You know, it's zipping through and they're dying quickly if with the right shot placement. So I don't really see a need to go with bigger heads. And for years, I kind of fought it. And then we had enough people that really just wanted a wider head for whitetails, bears, things where the shots are closer. And long range flight isn't so important, and just to get a bigger hole. When I first started making those and doing all the lab testing, I expected to see quite a bit higher force to penetrate with the wider blades. And I was a bit surprised that I don't measure much difference. And it's really kind of helped reinforce what I'd learned prior, is that sharpness and edge retention are huge factors in the force it takes to penetrate, especially in hide and, you know, muscle and tissue, but it seems to be in scapula as well. Now, I might say if, you know, bigger, heavier bone, you're probably gonna have less force to cut through with a head that's not quite so wide. But if I just measure the force to go through, see it through, say, hide, muscle, and like thin part of scapula, man, I have a hard time measuring a difference between our standard head and our wide, which is 1 3/8 wide main blade, 3/4 inch bleeder for 2 1/8 inch total cut. So I've kind of changed my thinking a little bit, and I don't see any problem with using that head on, you know, deer and elk. I use it a lot, but I also start using it on elk when I have a setup where I might be over water or I know the shot's going to be relatively close. It penetrates. You know, I put one through a bull last year, exited the opposite side shoulder bone, and then buried into a log 8 inches on the other side of the elk. So even though it's wide, it went through, you know, it wasn't the thin part. It wasn't the knuckle. It was kind of in between part of the shoulder bone, but it didn't really slow down. I think once the tip starts cutting away, and maybe on bone split, it's kind of split that far already. And maybe on the hide, once you start cutting, it doesn't take that much to keep cutting it a little wider. But I do think in general in the industry, if you look at broadheads beyond ours, you know, the more cutting, the wider cutting you do, takes more force, and it's probably going to give you less penetration in general.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's okay. Perfect. That's kind of what I thought, but it's that idea that it's going to, in my head, it's going to work if I hit it in the right spot and don't go through heavy bone. The 1 inch is still, or the 1/16 still going to do its job. But for the, you know, and I've went through, you know, right through the middle of the scapula before and broke through, but it's that instance, like, all right, I maybe have to go through there, or I miss just a little bit and go through there. I feel like it just gives me a little more margin of error, but you know, as you're saying, maybe not as much as we thought due to the, you know, the construction of the tip and how everything's working on those iron wheels.
Yeah. One thing I'd point out too, is that our newest head now is a wide single bevel head that we've had a lot of people asking us for. And I've been testing that over last year. And just a few weeks ago, I was in Texas hunting hogs with it. And one hog, you know, kind of a older boar that I shot a little further forward than I intended to. It was a 40-yard shot or some leaves covering his head. And I ended up shooting too far forward. I went right through the knuckle on that hog. And that was probably 2.5 inches of solid bone. And it was a loud crack. And I thought, oh no, I hit something really hard. This will be a real test for that wider, wide single bevel that's trying to rotate, you know, through the bone too.
Yep. But
it made it through the bone and got, you know, all the way through the animal. The arrow didn't completely pass through, but the broadhead made an exit on their side. And that bone just cut clean in two, where you could just kind of pull it apart like a puzzle, put it back together. It was a slice all the way through. And so that was with our wide head. So again, I feel like it's going to, you know, you need the right steel, the right hardness, strength, and everything to be able to cut through that bone. But it was good to see that even with the wide we went through, probably the thickest bone you're going to see on an animal in North America.
Gotcha. Yeah, I had a question here coming up to, that would have been a great segue, you know, single bevel versus double bevel. You know, we kind of exhausted that on the listener questions, but are you seeing the ability, this is my last question on single, once again, bone, are you seeing a difference? Does that single bevel just have the ability to kind of torque its way through and rotate its way through bone better than double bevel? Or is that tonneau point on the double bevel able to break through bone similar, or is there an advantage of one to the other?
Yeah, good, great question. And, you know, over many years of testing, I've kind of struggled to find a difference for bone splitting ability. I know that was, it's set out there a lot that the single bevels rotate and pop bone apart. I've talked to Dr. Ashby directly about that and how my results were a bit different. And, you know, he was using a very long, like 3-to-1 ratio head. He had a very slow longbow setup. And he was seeing where a double bevel could kind of just kind of wedge into that bone and take more force to penetrate versus that single bevel. As it started rotating, it was kind of popping bone and reducing the force for him to penetrate. It was an improvement. And I think I've talked to this and with him a number of times now, and I feel like with my setup being a modern compound bow, I had so much more energy that when the tip of, in our tanto tip shape, when that enters the bone, starts piercing that bone, it's popping it apart. It's cutting it apart very quickly, you know, and doing a great job penetrating. And that single bevel, as it's cutting in and popping it apart, you know, it's hard for me to see a difference in that, at least with my setup and my levels of energy. It might be more of a factor with a low, you know, lower energy setup, thicker, longer, you know, thicker bones, but I'm generally not seeing it. I'm popping through. You know, I do a lot of testing on, you know, cattle femurs, things like that. And I'm seeing them both are popping through with no problem.
Gotcha. So we're going to, this will be my last question for you. You kind of rolled it up a little bit, you know, for elk when you're, you know, in close proximity, but you know, we got a lot of whitetail hunters out there. You know, so for setting up for elk, what would you recommend the best broadhead for whitetail hunters, you know, to be, you know, out of a tree stand, if that changes angles and all of that, do you have a recommendation for that? Or is it just typically your wider angles?
Yeah. You know, I've shot all of our broadheads on quite a few whitetails at this point. And I could say that, you know, they all do a good job. They all, you know, zip through quickly, cut through bones, open up shot angles and opportunities there. That's really kind of what I tell people, that, you know, might shoot mechanical or want to know what, how is our head better than a mechanical at a whitetail, it's, I'm generally telling them it's opening up shot angles. And, you know, if you shoot a mechanical, hit them where they're soft and you're probably fine. But with ours, if, you know, that animal ducks and turns into it and you have to go through the shoulder blade, even the thickest part of the shoulder bone, it's going to penetrate and it's going to get you through the vitals. Or if it's a downward shot through the spine. And really, I'd say that about any of our heads that we make. They're all going to be able to make those shots. I'm generally personally using our wides now more on whitetails. It's just that the shots are, you know, typically 20 to 30 yards. Rarely are they over 40 in a whitetail woods. And so I know our wides are going to penetrate great. Why not get a little bigger hole? If there's a more marginal shot, let's say you end up hitting, you know, one lung, liver, guts. I've done that a number of times. And with our wide bevel with that 2 1/8-inch total cut between the main blade and the bleeder, you know, often they're going maybe 60, 70 yards and dying, even with a single lung, liver shot. It's just doing enough trauma that they're going down quickly. So that's kind of the advantage of why shoot maybe a wide over a smaller one is just more, you know, more bleeding, potentially quicker kills. So that's what I generally recommend on whitetails, our wide series. And that's what I generally recommend on bears as well, which are similar. Yeah. Closer shots and bears, especially with all that hair, it's important to get an exit hole there. That's talking to the outfitter again in Canada a few weeks back. A lot of guys are coming up there shooting mechanicals. And if they're a little bit quartered away and hitting the opposite side shoulder, they're not getting pass throughs. And then they got a high entrance hole, no exit hole. And on a bear, that means no blood trail. Cause it just soaks up that blood so much. So, whitetails, bears, I generally recommend our wide heads for those shots.
Gotcha. Yeah. Thanks for that. Bill, tell everybody how they can follow along, follow the company on social media, check out more. And if there's anything else you'd like to throw in that we didn't cover here, feel free to do that as well.
Yeah. Our website is Iron Will Outfitters. We're on, you know, Instagram, Facebook is Iron Will Outfitters. Also, we have a YouTube channel. It's also Iron Will Outfitters. And I'm committed to improving, you know, bow hunting, applying science to make better products. We make broadheads. You're currently working on making better arrows. We've started, you know, through the university study, we found the best thing from the study was this hybrid hunter vein, which is the Max Hunter profile and a new hybrid material that we had AE make for us, and worked with Easton to machine flex these at 3-degree helical, so that all the people ask me, you know, what arrow setup should I use with your broadheads? I can just say, hey, the one we saw right now kind of did the best overall in the study. And, you know, we know this is going to work well to make our heads fly well. And really, if you have a bow tune, so your arrow's coming relatively straight off of it, you're properly spined, and then you have enough vein on the back to stabilize that fixed blade head on the front. You should have good arrow flight. And we have great tech support. If people are having any problems with our broadheads in flight, we're happy to help you get that set up. But I want to throw that out there too, that I want to help the bow hunters be more successful, and we're happy to help you do that.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Bill. Thanks for jumping on. Good luck this fall if I don't talk to you before then, and always appreciate your knowledge and perspective. You know, in your opinions, whatever you may throw at this, because I know you've tested it and confirmed it. So really appreciate having you on, and take care.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. It's good talking to another engineer. And I know I might have got a little bit too into the details, but hopefully people have some takeaways from it. But yeah, thanks a lot for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. Take care. Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.